Good afternoon. It's Friday the 19th of April 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today via video link, we've got Ben Rubin and Debbie Evans. We're going to get started today with the discussion or the debate, if you could call it that, on excess mortality in the House of Commons yesterday. Well, as you can see, it was a packed house with all of about 10 or 15 people there. So if you have an MP that wasn't there, maybe the first thing that needs to be done is to ask them why they weren't there. Andrew Bridgen, of course, had organised this. Cheryl Granger, who is often on this programme, was attending. So we've got some comments from her in front of me at the moment. So it was quite a rowdy public gallery for this particular thing, as we'll hear in a moment. Lots of cheering and clapping going on. Much upset from the speaker that it was going on. There were MPs who backed Andrew Bridgen's comments and Cheryl saying mainly those with a scientific background. So Neil Hanvey MP, who was a clinical specialist, or is a clinical specialist background, he was talking about good clinical practice and the failure by the vaccine companies to follow protocols. Graham Stringer MP from Labour, it was someone tried at the beginning of COVID to bring Parliament back to debate during the lockdown, but and Cheryl thought his presentation was very good. There were interruptions by Dr. Mike Spencer, who's a conservative, an ex-consultant psychiatrist, and he was criticising everything, including doctors signing death certificates as COVID in order to inflate numbers. And so on. Sir Christopher Chope said quite a bit, Danny Kruger, and so on. So it was the people that did turn up had, at least some of them had a reasonable comments to make and so on. So let's just have a look at a couple of clips. First of all, Andrew Bridgen some of the response from the public gallery.
And given the evidence, Madam Deputy Speaker, I call on the government once again to immediately suspend the use of all mRNA treatments in both humans and animals, pending the outcome of that inquiry.
No. We would have to clear the gallery if clapping continues. I would order it if necessary. No.
So the gallery was absolutely packed. Debbie, how many people do you know? How many people attended?
I do indeed. Thanks to Cheryl very much. There were 100 in the gallery. I mean, my goodness, that cheering, it sounded like a general election had been won. But apparently Cheryl said that there was bulletproof glass from floor to ceiling, and they'd already been warned 3 times by palace officials not to cheer. But eventually they warned the gallery that if they cheered one more time, the speaker would try to shut them down. And that's exactly what was happening. They were trying to shut them down, trying to reduce Andrew Bridgen's speech. But yes, 100 in the gallery and very vocal.
Okay, so let's just have a look at a second clip from Andrew Bridgen.
The mRNA goes into them, it makes them create spike, or attacked by our immune system. That explodes into your blood supply. That's a blood clot. If that goes to the heart, you have a heart attack. If it goes to the brain or the lungs, you have a stroke or a pulmonary embolism. That's the link, Madam Deputy Speaker.
I accept that that's what the other gentleman's...
I'm sorry.
The honourable gentleman must resume his seat. This is the final warning. If there is, it is simply not acceptable for there to be clapping in the gallery when particular members speak. And if there is any other repeat of it, I will ask for the gallery to be cleared. I just want to be absolutely clear that that is the position that I will take, because it's not what happens in the chamber and the gallery. So, Christopher Chope.
Now, Debbie, the question on my mind is, who is representing the government? Because we're talking about healthcare and health issues and excess mortality. Surely the Secretary of State for Health was there.
I'm afraid she wasn't. I don't know where Victoria Atkins was, but she didn't feel that that debate was important enough for her to attend. And Maria Caulfield was attending, and she was rechurning the same old stuff that she'd rechurned before.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what Maria Caulfield had to say.
But excess deaths are not new. They were before COVID, and they are since COVID as well. But it's important to look at the figures, because the Office for National Statistics indicate that the number of excess deaths have been reducing year on year since the high of 2020, when there were 66,740 excess deaths in England. And I can only talk about England because health is obviously devolved, and governments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland will have their own data. But in 2022, that went down to 37,701. And in 2023, there were just 10,206 excess deaths in England.
So the ONS is showing that excess deaths have been falling since 2020. Is that the case? Well, of course, it's only the case because they have changed the methodology. And the way they've changed the methodology, of course, reduces the numbers of people that are being assessed as being excess deaths. So this is the release from them a couple of months ago, estimating excess deaths in the UK, methodology changes February 2024. And what comes across very clearly as you read down through this is that they're now using a very clear, or actually a very complex statistical formula for working excess mortality out, which is not related to what was previously a relatively simple average of the previous 5 years. But if we put that back on screen for a second, we'll just look further on down this. And you can sort of see on the right-hand side there the effect that the change in methodology has had. So the light blue line is the new methodology, the dark blue line is the old methodology. And you can see as we head towards the right-hand side of that graphic that the gap between those lines diverges as the new methodology massages the figures, let's say, in order to make it seem not quite as bad as they are. The important thing to recognize here is that what we're talking about here is a statistical guess. It's not the true number of people that have died. It's a guess based on statistics. And then the final comment to make on this is that Maria Caulfield there talking about not being able to provide numbers for Wales. Well, actually, the Office for National Statistics in their death releases, the death statistics releases each week, publishes data for England and Wales together. So I'm not clear what she was talking about there. Maybe she wasn't properly briefed. But anyway, Debbie, let's come on to what your thoughts are. Bring us up to date on health.
Well, yes, and it actually it goes in very well with the previous segment, because I don't know how many people that are going to be watching that are going to reverberate with this segment in how many mistakes are being made in the NHS, how many avoidable deaths are happening in the NHS, and are the NHS listening to us? So do you remember a couple of years ago, I confronted Jeremy Hunt on a Zoom call. He was like the rabbit in the headlights, and I asked him about vaccine serious adverse events, and also an investigation into them immediately. But he also revealed some shocking data. Let's have a listen.
The MHRA obviously are in charge of patient safety when it comes to pharmacovigilance, and the PEAG group at the Commission for Human Medicines. But according to the MHRA data, as I'm seeing today, as of today, there are over 1.5 million serious adverse reactions and 2,000 deaths. I just wondered what your thoughts were with regarding to an investigation on the serious adverse reactions that we're currently seeing. Thank you.
Debbie's question, I want to take that away because I think it's something that my committee might be interested in looking at. And I'll need to talk to my other members of my committee because we decide these things democratically. But when I was Health Secretary, I commissioned the University of Sheffield, Leeds and Manchester to do a report onto medication error. And, you know, we found there were 8,000 deaths a year. And, you know, obviously, we are very concerned about the adverse reactions that we have from the COVID vaccines. It's not for me to make a judgment as to the balance of risk But I think we do need to fully understand the issues that you raise.
Well, he's clearly not concerned because he never did anything about it. But he did say there 8,000 deaths a year. That was back in 2017. Now, that equates to about 22 a day of medication errors. So I want to bring your attention to a report that was published in 2023 called Broken Trust, which is about making patient safety more than just a promises. Perhaps this report should be called Broken Promises. It's been written by the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman. But what does the Ombudsman actually do? Let's see what the Ombudsman does, because the Ombudsman is there to make the final decision on any complaint that hasn't been resolved within the NHS government departments or other public agencies. So basically, the buck stops there with the Ombudsman. And when you go to look at the foreword in the report, it says this must never happen again. And it harps back onto the maternity services at Eastbourne scandal, East Kent, Morecambe Bay. And of course, let's not forget mid-staffs. But actually, this is happening more. And the person that wrote that foreword was Rob Berrens, who was the current, or who was at the time, the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman. And he says, but the biggest threat to patient safety is a system at breaking point. In this report, we recognise that the NHS itself can only go so far in improving patient safety. We need to see concerted and sustained action from government to make sure NHS leaders have the tools to prioritise the safety of patients and are accountable for doing so. This means getting past politics to put patient safety at the very top of the agenda. Please remember that, patients first. Let's look at what the report found. And I'm going to ask you to freeze the screen and read some of this because there's a lot to go through. But the four leading causes, direct causes of harm are failure to make a right diagnosis, delays in providing treatment, poor handovers between clinicians, and a failure to listen. And on top of that, there's compounded harm, which basically means that when a family has lost a loved one, they get stonewalled on top of having to go through the grief of something that's gone horribly wrong during their stay that's resulted in their death. So they developed the report over 3 years. So bearing in mind this was published in 2023, so this was started in 2020, 400 detailed health complaints they went through, and they found that 22 cases of death were more likely than not avoidable. Now, those 22 cases, they say, are a significant sample of a much bigger problem. And please note that these deaths were taking place in hospital, A&E, ICU, and general medical wards, which are generally full of elderly patients, to be quite honest. So let's look at the recommendations for this report. So they recommend that basically you should train new staff. Well, my question would be, is are we looking at quantity over quality, and what kind of staff and who are we training? They want to attract old staff back, and they want to recruit and retain staff. And they also talk about mixing skills, so swapping skills, like pharmacists can now prescribe for certain conditions, etc. So I want to introduce you, well, actually, before I do introduce you to someone, I want you to harp back to my Zoom with Jeremy Hunt, because I want you to listen to the words that he says, and he talks about candor. And when he talks about the duty of candor, what he means is a general duty to be open and transparent. So everyone to be honest. So let's listen to what he said to me 2 years ago.
Somebody who very sadly lost their daughter in a terrible error because sepsis wasn't spotted early enough. And it was the most sad story, but the one ray of sunshine is that the hospital have been totally honest and transparent about what happened, and clearly want to learn from it, and that is something that was possible because we now have a duty of candor. I don't think the duty of candor is implemented universally as well as it needs to be, but it's a big step forward from the sort of cover-ups that used to be very common. So there's that.
Cover-ups.
candour. So I want to introduce you to Rebecca Hilzenrath. Now, she was announced last year as the new ombudsman. And she was recently speaking this week, in fact, at a parliamentary health committee. And I'd really like you to hear what she had to say.
To somebody who's out there listening to this today, a lot of it sounds like we're protecting ourselves. Mistakes are still happening, things are not going the right way, and all we seem to be doing is making excuses.
I think the difference, the critical difference that will be made to people who are NHS users is an improvement of their communication with the NHS. It is the key thing that we see in our casework over and over again is poor communication. It comes in the Kirkup reviews and in other areas of investigation. It's not just about what happens when things go wrong. That's critical, where we see a lack of transparency. It is also what happens before then, when people are giving views about what's going on with themselves or their loved ones, they're not listened to. One of the cases in our broken trust report was about a man who came to an emergency department multiple times with his mother. Symptoms weren't listened to, symptoms were not taken seriously, and she died of a stroke, which was entirely avoidable had they been listened to and had treatment been administered earlier. And it's all about being listened to, being communicated with, and having that honesty of engagement. We welcome the government's agreement to review the duty of candour, which we have said for some time is not being properly implemented. We call for that as part of our broken trust report, and we look forward to contributing to it. And that, we think, lies at the heart of the trust between users of the NHS and the people that they work with.
Clearly, we have not moved forward at all because we are seeing many, many more incidences of exactly what she was describing. And I'm sure many people watching will be nodding their heads or they'll know of someone that has experienced similar. But also at that select committee, there was someone else. And I just want to bring you back to the junior doctors. And I hope that there are a lot of junior doctors that are watching UK Column. And if you're not, junior doctors, perhaps you ought to just switch on now, because we've recently been told that you're going to continue to take industrial action. And this industrial action could go on for the next 9 months. So I want to introduce you to, again, the NHS Confederation. Now, we've mentioned the NHS Confederation.
Okay. That's unfortunate. So we're going to have to come back to this topic later on, if we possibly can. Debbie's not coming back in a hurry. So we'll come back to this, and I'll bring Ben on the program. Welcome to the program, Ben. And, well, I think I'd like to know who Shola is.
Wouldn't we all like to know who Shola is? So we're referring to this lady, Dr. Shola Mose Shogbamimu. Here we go. Another little click. We can get her name up on the bottom left-hand corner there. There we are. Dr. Shola Mose Shogbamimu, who for brevity I will call Shola or Dr. Shola in this piece because her name is a little bit of a mouthful. She's a Nigerian-British lawyer, campaigner, author and broadcaster. And the question I'm trying to answer today, or we're at least going to dig into it, is Shola working for the Israeli state? Now, first of all, let's allow Shola to introduce herself in this short clip talking to Good Morning Britain about the royal family from a couple of years ago.
At the heart of this, Dr. Shola, do you believe that racism is to play? I mean, this is a question that you feel actually you're exhausted of having to defend it, because for you, it's so blatant that, yes, the answer is yes, racism is to play.
You've taken the words right out of my mouth. It is exhausting when you keep hearing people either deny that racism is at the heart of this. Mm. People go, it's criticism, but it's criticism steeped in racism. And look, I think that the difficulty here for a lot of people is that they do not understand this thing. And the thing is that it is not the job of black people and ethnic minorities to educate white people on racism that is perpetrated by white people. Right. White folks need to go educate themselves on the racism they perpetrate. Mm. The reason why the racism experienced by Megan feels so personal and it deeply resonates with a lot of people is because it's symptomatic of the culture of racism in the United Kingdom.
What examples do you have?
You see, that is another problem. When people keep asking what examples, it makes me question where have you been the last 2 years?
Yeah, see, you get the idea, right? So it's racism, racism, racism. Everyone's racist. Can you give us some examples? No, we can't give you any examples of racism. It's on you to go and educate yourself. We don't actually have to provide any proof. Classic race grifter. That's what Dr. Shola is. That's what she's been up to. That was a Kafka trap, actually. This is a tool of totalitarian regimes. It's a logical fallacy where an individual is accused of something, and any attempt to deny or defend themselves against the accusation is then considered as evidence of their guilt, right? So that's what Shola was up to in that clip towards the end there. That's this entire ideological paradigm that we've been subjected to in this country and elsewhere over the past few years. Now, she is very critical of Israel. She certainly has been. She's described them as behaving like Nazi Germany recently on Twitter. She's also demanded that the Israeli ambassador Zippy Hotovly, I love that name, be expelled from the UK. She made that a demand again recently on Twitter, very active on Twitter, all over social media. She's been sharing lots of pro-Palestinian material online. And she's even joking, interestingly, and this is what spurred me to do this little segment. She's been joking about her relationship with the Israeli state, right? So you can see here, this is from her Instagram. She says, I've just returned from Israel and you'll be seeing a lot more of me on your TV screens. The Israeli government has offered me and I've accepted the role as its new and first black UK spokesperson. I drop into the bottom there. My reputation precedes me as I bring the requisite skills set of obfuscation, deflection, baiting and gaslighting that are second to none from a decade of grifting to this challenging role. Obviously, she says this like it's a joke, but actually I think there's a lot of truth in there. And I'd be very interested to know what her relationship with Israel and their intelligence services is. Now, let's dig into this a little bit further. I want to draw your attention to this organisation that we've spoken about before, the UK youth charity My Life, My Say, which is focused on the radical transformation of British society, indoctrinating young people in these extreme left-wing ideologies, critical race theory, that kind of thing, and ultimately focused on overwhelming the democratic process. They partnered with, amongst other people, and they have a huge number of partners, right? Amongst other people, the US State Department via the US Embassy in London, MI6 via their chairman, Andrew Ruffin. They have a representative of the Rothschild family on the board of My Life, My Say, by this who actually works as part of this organization, R&Co Four Generations, which is a philanthropic fund run out of Paris on behalf of the Rothschild family, focused on delivering the sustainable development goals. And My Life, My Say also partners with Tortoise Media, who we've spoken about a lot over the past couple of months on the news. Because Tortoise Media is a long-term strategic partner of the Rothschild Foundation. And the Rothschild Foundation's Israeli counterpart is called Yad Hanadiv. And Yad Hanadiv was the institutional vehicle used to found Israel and build its main institutional buildings, including the Israeli Supreme Court. You can see here this image again. We showed this a few weeks ago. You can see Lord Jacob Rothschild, recently deceased, second from the right, looking at an architectural model of the Israeli Supreme Court. And he funded the build of that, of the creation of that building, and also the Knesset. So Rothschild and Tortoise are inextricably linked with each other. And in November 2021, My Life, My Say, which is connected to all of these organizations that we've just described, hosted this event, the Common Futures Forum. Note the language, Common Futures, sounds a bit common purpose, doesn't it? And this was held at the mayor's office. So Sadiq Khan was in. And the headline speaker at this event was Dr. Shola, speaking alongside Reverend Al Sharpton. So this was to round off the day. They'd have a full day of speakers. A lot of this very racially charged, very radical leftist rhetoric being put forth. And Dr. Shola was front and centre. She was the blockbuster main attraction, or it was probably Al Sharpton, but she was certainly sitting on stage alongside him, which places her directly at the centre of this network of organisations, which are directly linked to, and I would actually suggest almost certainly controlled by the Israeli state. Isn't that interesting, Shola? Now, it still doesn't make sense. Sorry, go on, Mike. You wanted to jump in there.
No, you go ahead.
So, I mean, it still doesn't quite make sense, though, does it, right? So despite all of these connections, she is actually being critical of Israel, isn't she? So how can she be a friend of Israel, given that? Well, the way I see it is that the biggest challenge that we have right now regarding the Middle East, or certainly one of the biggest challenges, is actually having a sensible conversation with the British population about what is happening in the Middle East. Now, 85% of the population in this country are white Europeans, and Shola has been attacking them, us, for the past 5 years, gaslighting us and ultimately psychologically abusing us via TV and social media and using these radical left-wing ideologies. People don't like it. They shouldn't have to put up with it. And her being on the side of the Palestinians makes it a lot more difficult for them to listen to criticism of Israel and to empathize with the Palestinian cause. And ultimately, her behavior is helping to prolong and perpetuate the genocide against the Palestinian people, whether she realizes it or not.
Yeah. Okay, Ben, thank you. Debbie is back with us. So, Debbie, we'd got to the NHS Confederation.
Oh, maybe they didn't want me to give my message to the junior doctors, because this is what this is for, my friends and colleagues, junior doctors, I hope you're watching. So, yes, so we're going back to the Health and Select Committee. So also there present was Matthew Taylor. Now, Matthew Taylor is the CEO of the NHS Confederation. Now, just to remind you, the NHS Confederation is the membership organisation that brings together, supports and speaks for the whole healthcare system in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Now, I'm sure we all remember junior doctors are still on industrial action. They're going to carry on, and they're going to carry on striking for the next 9 months. At least. Now, Matthew Taylor was at the Select Committee, the very same one as the Ombudsman. And I'm going to say, are junior doctors, the turkeys at Christmas, are junior doctors being blamed for excess deaths? Are junior doctors being blamed for bed blocking? And are junior doctors actually being set up to fail? And who comes first with regards to risk? Patients or compliance? And in this next little clip of Matthew Taylor speaking at the Select Committee this week, he makes some shocking revelations. Have a listen.
We need to be open to the public about risk.
The avoidance of risk does not always improve the overall outcome for patients. And if I can give you an example of this, during junior doctor strikes, I visit hospitals, and hospitals feel like, in some senses, more functional places when junior doctors are on strike. And that's because the consultants are not doing their outpatients clinics or whatever, they're in the hospital. Now, that means in some ways the hospital runs more effectively. It also means that the backlog is building up, the waiting list is building up. Now, the reason for that is because more senior members of staff are more willing to take risks. They have greater confidence in doing that. I was in a hospital a couple of weeks ago where they have people in the emergency department waiting medical assessment. These people are overwhelmingly elderly, frail people. And the hospital manager said, if my consultant gerontologist is on duty, he will go down this line of patients and he will work out how to discharge each of them, because he knows that to admit somebody like this, an elderly, frail person, to hospital is almost never good for them. Will lead to them being deconditioned and could lead to them also getting trapped in hospital, which, you know, is a real issue for the hospital and its resources, etc. If, however, a junior doctor, less experienced, under pressure, goes down this line, they're quite likely to recommend that these patients have tests, which could be intrusive, and that a couple of them will be admitted, because the risk of admitting is much lower than the risk of discharging, and then that patient dies, and the relatives understandably say, well, you know, you didn't do the right thing. I spoke to another hospital leader the other day, and you know, it is an anecdote, but who said they'd been into a, you know, maternity ward, and it felt that an enormous amount of time now was being spent on compliance rather than being spent with patients. Now, I don't say attest to the truth of that, that's one story, but what I would want you to understand is that sometimes the systems that seek to minimize risk do not lead aggregately to the best outcomes for patients, and that's something I don't think we always give proper consideration to.
Fantastic, thank you.
More time on compliance than patients, and my question to junior doctors is, with the metaverse, robots, virtual care, do we need junior doctors? Will we need them in the future?
Does you'd like to support us, please head over to support.ukcolumn.org if we can get that on screen, and all the options are there for you to help us out if you possibly can. We do need your support because we can only do this with it, so thank you very much to everybody that has joined as a member or made a donation, but that's there if you would like to contribute. Please share anything you find on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. You can pick something up at the UK Column shop. There's plenty of stuff there if you'd like to do that as well. Quick reminder that Brian's premiere of the third episode of Walking the Dog is on Sunday on his YouTube channel. The link will be in the show notes under the program. That's at 11 a.m. on Sunday. And at 6 p.m. on Sunday, we will be hosting a symposium on behalf of the Heritage Party, which is entitled Defying the Real Enemy. They're saying that the Heritage Party councillors are discussing structure of our political system, a topic which is frequently misunderstood by the majority of people. The conversation will center on identifying the true culprits behind detrimental changes in our nation. So there are going to be five people taking part in that. Madeline Hunt, who has been an interviewee on the UK Column. Also, four other Heritage Party local councillors, Sarah Farrell, Matthew Kellerman, Sean Turner, and Becca Collings. So join us for that at 6 p.m. on Sunday if you can. Then on Monday at 2 p.m., Playing God, Jackie Du Bois, documentary on democide in the NHS will be premiering on UK Column. So if you can possibly join us for that at 2 p.m. immediately after the news program, do join us then. Then a final reminder, or a quick reminder here, for the Sounds Beautiful Festival taking place June 27th to the 30th in Wimborne and Dorset, and the Stand in the Light Festival taking place in Cumbria on May the 24th to the 27th. Get along to those if you possibly can. Now, the news from the Middle East is that Israel has apparently launched some kind of attack on Iran. This is the Islamic Republic news agency talking about that. Air defense system activated as blast heard in Iran's Isfahan. That's according to an official. It's not clear exactly how significant this attack was at this point. The Iranians absolutely downplaying it. It doesn't sound like it was anything other than a number of small drones. This is Iran destroys several micro air vehicles over Isfahan. And so apparently small drones. And the suggestion is that this was actually Israel attempting to deal with Iran's air defense radar systems. And perhaps there's going to be some kind of follow-up. So it remains to be seen whether that's the case. But as I say, various reports in the mainstream press at least suggesting that Tehran is playing down the significance of it. But there are a number of questions to be asked here with mainstream media coverage of the whole thing, because here's the Jerusalem Post and their tweet from this morning. An Israeli missile strike targeted a site in Iran early Friday morning, two Israeli defense officials confirmed. And they have this image showing a large explosion. The image is captioned, "Explosions heard in Iran, Syria and Iraq." But here's the problem. That is not the correct image. So this is Islamic Jihad rockets killed more civilians in Gaza than IDF airstrikes did from 2022. And that's more or less the same image. It's certainly the same, an image of the same event from more or less the same position. If we just have a look at them and compare them again, you can see that absolutely. And the caption on this image, making sure that you understand that this is a ball of fire and smoke rising during Israeli airstrikes in Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip on the 5th of August, 2022. So what on earth does the mainstream media think they're doing? The Israeli mainstream media think they're doing, putting fake images out to describe this. It doesn't end there. Other people commenting on this from other places. So this is Iran Observer making the point, Israeli media shows video of Lebanese Hezbollah missile strike on Mayan Brook as a strike on Iran. This is pure face-saving. So, well, it's not really clear whether it's face-saving or attempting to make a bigger issue of it than it was, because it might be face-saving if the event was a failure from Israel's point of view. On the other hand, if they intend to follow up, if this was just a probe and they intend to follow up, then face-saving isn't quite the correct way to show it. But nonetheless, the media doing their usual job of pushing out more fake news than anybody else. But Ben, you've got more on this, because we were talking on the program on Monday, I think, or on Wednesday, about the relative cost between it with respect to the Iranian airstrike on Israel, the relative cost on them making that strike and Israel's defense of it.
Yes, it was Vanessa's piece on Monday. I was really struck by it. It was a great piece of reporting, and there were some numbers that jumped out at me that made me think of some of my sort of business theories that I've been steeped in over my career. And it's this idea of disruptive innovation, which is a process where a smaller company with fewer resources is able to successfully challenge established incumbent businesses. That's generally driven by increased performance of new technologies. So over time, new technologies achieve parity with existing ones, and ultimately they surpass the performance of those existing technologies. If we could just get that slide up on screen, actually, that'd be great. Yeah, so you can see that the top line is sustaining innovation in an existing technological paradigm, and then the bottom green line is the disruptive technology increasing in performance over time to the point where it attains parity, but at a much reduced cost, which is really, really important. And we can see this playing out in the markets. The very famous example that always gets used is Blockbuster Video, the iconic brand of the 80s and 90s. That was destroyed by Netflix because of the internet. Same thing happened with Napster and the mainstream music industry at around the same time. So the internet was the new technology paradigm that came in and replaced the existing VHS or CD paradigm that was in place. And I think that we're actually watching in real time the same thing happening now between Israel and Iran. So the two data points that really jumped out at me were this one, Israel spent $1.35 billion overnight defending itself from an attack that, according to this gentleman, Professor Syed Mohammed Marandi, being interviewed on Sky News on the same report, cost Iran between $30 and $60 million to carry out, right? So Israel has spent $1.3 billion against $30 to $60 million, right? So for 3 to 5% of the cost, Iran has essentially reached parity with Israel in this attack. And that, to me, means without question that Israel and ultimately the US and the UK military industrial complex has already lost this fight. That's not a war that can be won.
Ben, as we were discussing before the beginning of the program, of course, we see the same thing in Ukraine. In fact, we see the same thing with the scale of defense budgets in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe by comparison with defense budgets in Russia and China, for example. And yet they absolutely have parity with respect to capability, if not more capability. I mean, I think we could argue that they have more capability in some areas for a much less cost. So this isn't just about Israel and Iran.
No, it's the entire Western military-industrial complex and all of the fat, ultimately, that exists within it, you know, because of all of those contracts, it's just bunts going to vested interests, and ultimately that's going to be the downfall of the entire thing.
Yes. Thanks, Ben. Okay. Now, something else Vanessa has been talking about over the last couple of months has been Unit 8200. We've talked about it as well over the years, but she was focusing on the relationship with the tech industry. And so, let's just bring their logo on screen. Here it is. Now, of course, 8200, what do we say about it? It is a signals intelligence agency. So it's equivalent, it's Israel's equivalent to the NSA in the United States or GCHQ in the UK. But it's not just a signals intelligence agency. It's also a cyber warfare agency because, for example, it released the Stuxnet virus, which disabled nuclear centrifuges in Iran. Operation Orchard they ran, where they jammed Syrian radar systems which were related to Syrian air defenses. The Agero incident, which is the Lebanese government blamed Israel for having launched a sophisticated cyber attack on their communications company, Agero, and they used it to spread disinformation directly to people through the telecoms networks. So they do much more than just signals intelligence. But then there's the other aspect of this, which is the seeding of technology companies, not only through personnel that have been trained or have operated through 8200, but also with financing as well. We should just mention in passing that, of course, in recent days, 8200 has been in the press because of Project Nimbus. Now, this is a headline in TechCrunch. Google fires 28 employees after a sit-in protest over controversial Project Nimbus contract with Israel. And this is a cloud infrastructure project which Google is contributing to. I think it's $1.2 billion or so. But 8200 personnel involved with that and so on. But now I'm going to just move to the side a little bit for a second because in the recent couple of years, we've seen a lot of propaganda in the mainstream press with respect to Huawei, which is a Chinese company, and its use of Huawei technology in the UK telecoms infrastructure and various people, including various integrity initiative aficionados such as Edward Lucas that we were speaking about a couple of days ago, very concerned that this is a national security risk. Huawei gear on UK telecoms networks, the Huawei will be hoovering up bulk data, sending it back to the Chinese Communist Party is basically the idea here. And so why is this a concern? Well, because, of course, we're seeing dual use in terms of infrastructure, so not just civilian use for 5G networks or for satellite networks. Ben Wallace talking about satellite networks in this case, and the fact that the government now owns the OneWeb satellite system will ensure that we embed dual use at the heart of everything, including security and intelligence services and commercial partners, commercial users, and so on. So coming back then, so if my question then is, if it is a national security risk to have Huawei equipment on our telecoms networks, might there be other national security risks here? So let's look at 8200 again and look at two organizations that 8200 has spawned. First of all, Checkpoint, and second of all, Palo Alto Networks. Now, Checkpoint is a cybersecurity company. They're most famous for producing firewall appliances that just about everybody used. I mean, they were at one point absolutely ubiquitous with respect to firewalls. And of course, what is a firewall? It is a piece of equipment that you put on your internal network, which processes every packet of data that goes between your internal network, whether you're a government or a local council or a company, and between your internal network and the internet, and is capable of a deep packet inspection and so on, with a view to worrying about cyber threats and making sure that your internal network is provided, but that is protected. Sorry, but that data passes through that device, and so is it perhaps an opportunity for a signals intelligence agency to bulk data collect? I leave that question open, but just to give, we'll just look at Checkpoint for a start and their leadership. So this is Gil Shved. He is the co-founder and CEO of Checkpoint. He's Israel's eighth richest billionaire, reportedly worth $4.7 billion. Another person on the board, Dr. Dorit Dor, Chief Technology Officer, looking at rocket initiatives at the moment, but formerly Chief Product Officer, so of course responsible for the development of Checkpoint's products. And Checkpoint, part of a consortium of cyber companies, Israeli cyber companies, that are all involved in infrastructure in the West. And so the question is, what are we actually seeing here? So who is Checkpoint looking at? Well, working with, so they've got a collaboration that they've just announced recently, last month, with Microsoft to supercharge Infinity AI Copilot with Microsoft Azure Open AI Service. So they're getting into artificial intelligence as well. But just thinking about the UK, as I say, they're everywhere. So Denbighshire County Council here, if we can put that on screen, selecting Checkpoint's Eventia suite to simplify security management. The NHS has provided 7,000 workers with Checkpoint secured mobile phones and mobile devices. So, you know, what is the potential for data to be hoovered up by this Israeli company? And then if we look here, just very briefly to look at Palo Alto Networks, I'm not going to go into any detail with them, but this is their founder, Nir Zuk, another 8,200 alumnus. But let's just, people might say, well, okay, they worked for Unit 8,200 while they were living in Israel. Everybody is required to do national service in Israel. And of course, people that are interested in these kind of topics are going to end up working for them. And really, there's nothing to see here. But I would just ask the question again, if it's a national security risk to have Huawei gear on our telecoms networks, why is it not a national security risk to have Israeli gear on our networks, especially when that Israeli gear has been built and developed by people that have a history of working with the Israeli intelligence agencies? I think there are a lot of questions to be asked there. Okay, let's come back to you, Debbie, and the World Health Organization.
Yes, hola, Portugal, because that's who we're going to be focusing on in this segment. And don't we all love to follow a great example? So time's running out, as we know, for the WHO Pandemic Preparedness Treaty. The WHO, the World Health Authorization, are going to be, the WHA are going to be sitting next month in order to complete this. So time's running out. Now, you might remember a couple of years ago, I interviewed the wonderful dentist from Portugal, Martha da Silva Gamera. And she is literally incredible. She's been a one-woman band trying to get parliamentarians in Portugal to reject the WHO Pandemic Preparedness Treaty. Now, things work a little bit differently in Portugal in that petitions mean referendums and people are really welcome in Parliament. And Marta has got an urgent update for us. So if you're in Portugal, and even if you're a Brit living in Portugal, please listen because Marta needs your help.
Thank you, Debbie, and thank you for UK Column to listen to me. So after we went to the Parliament, and the report of that meeting takes too long because several questions. So all this process delay a little bit. And then our government fall, and we took about 4 months to have elections again. Because of that, only now, this is the first petition that will be discussed in Parliament with this government, with this Parliament. Only now, this will be discussed by all parties in Portugal. So, in the last year, I'm trying to talk about this with several MPs. I am very annoying. I'm always insisting. And in the last week, I talked with the third party in Portugal, the most conservative party, the Chega party. And yesterday, they finally take a public position about that. They are against pandemic treating, then they'll vote against all forms of the pandemic treaty. And yesterday too, I talked with an MP from the actual government, from the Commission on Health. Unfortunately, this MP in particular, he was one of the most, one of the persons that most promotes the measures of the pandemic. He agree with all of it. He's a doctor. He agree with all, and he is very aligned with how this is happening. He said, don't worry, this treaty have several issues. This could not be approved like this. Don't worry. Let's see the Portugal respond to European Union, not respond to WHO. So all the talk led me very, very even more concerned about this. So my hope is that the pressure from the civilian, the people, and the pressure from the Conservative Party, the Chega Party, will be at least enough to put all the MPs for several parties at least reading the articles and read and understand all the problems that a treaty like this can get.
Marta, thank you so much for that. Can I just ask you, what is your message now to people watching? What is your message to people in Portugal and all around the world?
All these are small steps, small step, small step. And I hope we achieve a great thing. So next step is to fool the parliament in the next April 23rd, 3 p.m. Lisbon time and UK time, is to fool the parliament with civilian people. We have to put pressure on the MPs so that understand this is a subject that there is a problem. This is a concern for the civilian people. This is problematic. We are worried about that. We have to put all the MPs reading the text and discuss this. So the next goal is to fool the parliament with civilian people. So I ask to all Portuguese people, and I know that there is a lot of British people in Portugal. You can come too. You can. The parliament is open to everybody. So I ask to all who is concerned with this, please come to the parliament 3 p.m. It's better to arrive a little bit earlier. 3 p.m. Parliament in Lisbon. Please. We want to make a great, grand, big group to go to the parliament and assist this plenary, this session, and tell the MPs, you are our representatives. You have to read this. You have to stop this. That is my ask. That's all I ask for the Portuguese people and the British people who live in Portugal. I know that it's a lot of people here.
World Health Assembly in May. Are you near to Lisbon on the 23rd at 3 o'clock? If you are, please fill up Parliament. Millions of people, please.
Debbie, thank you very much for that. Now, Ben, let's move on. And we've got another name for people, Mete Choban.
Yeah, Mete Choban. And we're going to go back to My Life, My Say, the UK youth charity that we were talking about earlier on. Mete Choban is the chief executive and the founder of My Life, My Say, that organisation that sits in the midst of the intelligence agencies and the Rothschilds. And he has been very active and excited this week because of a new campaign that they've launched to get young people out to vote. We have a video to run here.
Your film will be starting shortly. But before you switch your phones off, why not scan this QR code and register to vote? You vote to keep your favourite celebs in the house, the jungle, The Villa, and all your other favourite reality TV shows. But now it's time to vote for your own reality. Registration closes 16th of April. You already vote, so vote.
So that is the purpose of My Life, My Say, to get young people involved in the political process. It's why Coban got his MBE, actually. That ad campaign was produced by Ogilvy. It's one of the oldest, most established ad networks in the world. It's being shown in cinemas. So there's a huge amount of money that's gone in to back this campaign. It's been pushed by the BBC. So they sent a team down to record this little talk by Sharon Gafgar in a school in London during the week. The Loveys are all behind it. You can see the campaign for the arts here, talking about all of these famous actors who are behind the campaign. Of course they are. And it was really successful. So they had over 150,000 people registered to vote on New Voter Registration Day, which is what the campaign was focused around. And crucially, there were 113,000 under 25 and the 25 to 34-year-old segments that MLMS are focused on. So that's their core focus. They want young people getting involved in the political process. And supposedly this is nonpartisan, but on closer inspection, the ideological direction is really clear. Coban himself is a Labour councillor in Hackney. And here he is last night with Sadiq Khan pushing his mayoral campaign. So he's obviously very much in the left-wing Labour camp of British politics. And as we also know about Sadiq Khan, he is president of C40 Cities. And let's have a little look at what C40 Cities are promoting right this moment.
If you think green jobs start and end with installing solar panels, think again. Green jobs are preserving and caring for natural habitats, maintaining EV parks and charging stations, keeping our communities clean and safe from harmful waste, installing green walls to help clean the air we breathe, developing efficient and cost-saving renewable technologies, designing compact, walkable neighbourhoods. Green jobs of all kinds are essential to our transition to a more secure, sustainable and just economy. Green jobs foster healthier, thriving cities and help to reduce poverty and enhance social inclusion by providing stable and decent employment opportunities. If we want to build a future that works for everyone, we must rapidly prioritise and create more green jobs today.
Oh, the green transition. It all sounds so fantastic, didn't it? Did you catch the 15-minute cities reference? We want compact, walkable neighbourhoods, apparently, because we're not going to be allowed to go anywhere else. Well, that was a cartoon, right? But obviously that manifests in the real world, and it's manifesting in the real world right now, and Betty Choban is right at the forefront of it. So here he is earlier on this year. This is taken from the website of a company called Zest. And Zest is installing electric vehicle charging units in Hackney. Coban made a statement saying, amongst other things, that the switch to EVs will help tackle pollution and create a greener, healthier Hackney. We're really happy to be working in partnership with Zest, who are funding, installing and operating the new chargers. All right, and there's a statement here from the CEO of Zest, Robin Heath, saying that we're delighted to be working in long-term partnership with Hackney. The scale of this project shows what bold thinking and public-private partnership can achieve. So this is essentially a fascist system. Public-private partnership is fascist. The social equity built into the project means that people right across the borough will get access to EV infrastructure. They're big on equity. Like, they love this neo-Marxist terminology. And it then says, as a certified B Corp, we are committed to projects that deliver benefits for everyone. So it's a B Corp as well. And as we found out a couple of weeks ago when I covered B Corps, they are essentially there to help implement the sustainable development goals. They're inextricably linked. And all of this is being funded by the state. So that what I've just gone through there is paid for by the Levi scheme, the local electric vehicle infrastructure funding scheme, which has got £400 million worth of taxpayer money being diverted into places like Hackney, overseen by people like Mehdi Choban, who is working directly with Sadiq Khan, C40 Cities, the US intelligence agencies, the Rothschild families, to completely transform British society and overwhelm our democratic process. And that's what we're going to see a lot more of this year.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Well, we'll be reporting a lot more on this this year, I've no doubt. Thank you, Ben. Okay, well, look, we are out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there for today. I'm going to say thank you very much to Ben and Debbie for joining me today. Thank you all for watching. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with some extra. If you're a UK Column member, if you're not a UK Column member, please consider joining us, and then you can join us for the extra programs as well. Don't forget the symposium on Sunday, and Walking the Dog with Brian on Sunday morning on his YouTube channel. We'll see you on the news on Monday. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.